I'm Jen Taylor Skinner, and this is The Electorate. On this episode, I have a conversation with Alejandra Montoya Boyer, the Director of Policy at Prosperity Now, an organization focused on driving economic opportunity for everyone and creating an economy that is fair and free from structural racism. Alejandra and I talk about the most impactful ways to create economic equity, including, for example, legislation that expands the child tax credit. Also, investing in baby bonds. That's another way. And Alejandra explains exactly what baby bonds are because they probably aren't what you think they are. And Alejandra also explains how baby bonds can completely change the trajectory of someone's financial future. We also talk about how tweaking the IRS tax code can greatly reduce the wealth gap in this country, thus creating a fairer economy. So without further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Alejandra Montoya Boyer. Alejandra Montoya Boyer, welcome.
Thank you. Excited to be here.
So, you know, we've been hearing a lot of positive economic news lately. You know, great job reports have been coming out monthly, inflation's going down. And I think the assumption is that positive news translates to individual prosperity, but we know better. You know, what often gets lost, I think, in those numbers is the racial disparities and the wealth gap that grows year over year, decade over decade. It hasn't really gotten better. It's only gotten bigger, actually. And I know that there's probably a longer, more complex answer to this question. But what broadly contributes to that wealth gap growing in a climate where a lot of people are doing really well?
I mean, I think we have to start with the historical context. We really have to understand the way that our economic systems are set up, are built on centuries of wealth inequalities, of wealth stripping. And so really recognizing that while we're seeing trends toward, you know, like you said, better jobs, things are looking better than they were, particularly like during the peak pandemic years, we are still working through systems that have such hardened, cemented wealth inequities over centuries that for us to expect that to happen without very targeted and tailored policy solutions and systemic practices that are undoing that, we're just going to continue to see not only a continued racial wealth gap, but honestly, an exacerbation of it. We know right now the statistics are really showing that Black and Latina households have 15 to 20% of every white household's dollar, respectively. And so without an approach and really a race-conscious approach to the wealth gap, we're just not seeing the moves. And when it comes to, I mean, for example, like the job numbers, during the pandemic, the people that were hardest hit by job loss were Black and brown people, Black and brown workers, and particularly Black and Latina women because of the impact on caregiving, the fact that so many women of color had to leave the workforce to be able to care for their kids, care for loved ones, care for parents. And a huge challenge with the actual data collection is that when people leave the workforce, if they're not actively searching for jobs, they're no longer captured in the job number. So when we see that more and more people are, employment is going down and more people are going back to work, it's something to celebrate, but we have to recognize where the data actually has gaps and recognize that still millions of particularly women of color have not rejoined the workforce because of challenges with particularly around caregiving.
Thank you for giving me that concise kind of Cliff Notes version, because like I said, that's an answer that could take up an entire episode. It can take up an entire year, actually, because it's been happening over centuries and there's so many different complex structures and systems in place. There's bias in banks, there's bias in homeownership, there's bias just at every level of our society. And it's particularly stark among children. I mean, we have millions of children living in poverty in this country, and 70% of those children, I believe that's the figure, 70% of those children are children of color. First of all, I'm just curious as to how you measure that, where you get that data. How do we know how many children are in poverty right now?
So the data that gets collected, I mean, it's through a massive number of different sources in which we're able to bring together figures from the U.S. Census, from self-reporting that families do through like the ACS surveys. And then there's groups like Annie Casey that do Kids Count, which relies on grassroots, grass tops, and community organizations all across the country to report data on what's going on in specific states and localities. The biggest challenge, honestly, sometimes with the data is different places have slightly different numbers. It's an amalgamation of a number of different sources. And so when we look at child poverty, for example, it's not only are we looking at what people are self-reporting or responding to on the census, things like that, We also take data from schools, from community centers, community groups. Like, there's just a huge amount of effort that goes into actually measuring the problem, which, again, back to my previous point around some of the holes and gaps, I think that that doesn't always capture the full information and full picture, particularly when we look at underrepresented groups like Indigenous people, or if we're talking about racialized data, Asian Americans are particularly painted with a broad brush of Asian Americans are doing better in some cases than white households. But if we're actually able to disaggregate the data, children from Vietnamese, Thai, Hmong, Laotian families are actually doing far worse. A lot of that has to do with immigration status, about the way that they're coming to work in the United States. We are able to measure, and the numbers are very critical, especially when we are developing policy responses to that. But I want us to also be mindful that it doesn't always do enough on the data front for us.
I see. So speaking of the policy front, I know that there was a shift in 2021 due to the child tax credit. I don't know if you can speak to that, because I know millions of children were lifted out of poverty. And I'm just curious as to how we can measure that so quickly. And just tell me generally how that's helped the situation.
Yeah, I mean, the expanded child tax credit, which came through the American Rescue Plan, was such a huge change in our understanding of anti-poverty policy making, and really a true test of, like, if and the government can get money out to families, one, what is the infrastructure for us to be able to do that? And using the IRS and the tax code to be able to do that was massively effective. And if we're getting money out, is that actually what's helping pull people out of poverty? There has been a longstanding question of, is cash assistance or public benefits, tax credits, actually doing anything for poverty? And what we were able to show was that on this scale, when we were really being able to bring in, so under the expanded CTC, it added access to 27 million children who were previously, whose families were incomes were too low to qualify for the standard child tax credit before. Most of those families were Black and Latina children. We saw a decrease in poverty, and the numbers fluctuate. Overall, child poverty decreased by 45%. Poverty for Black children decreased by 52%, for Latina children by 45%, and for Indigenous children by 61%. Those are massive numbers over the amount of was about 7 months. We were able to collect that data, as I said, through predominantly through US Census and ACS survey data, but a number of organizations all across the country were collecting their own data, not just on poverty, the actual poverty numbers, but also what were families actually putting their payments toward, really showing, particularly breaking a really racialized and awful myth about cash assistance and funding that attaches it to work and the work requirements that we want to place on cash assistance, and really dispelling the myth that people actually want to work. And when we provide a cushion of cash assistance, most families are putting that toward not just basic necessities like housing and food, but toward childcare or transportation, which are critical costs to be able to get people to work. The child tax credit, I really can't say highly enough about, like, it was such a massive opportunity for us from a data standpoint, from a policy experimentation standpoint, to be able to say, okay, we have a crisis with kids living in poverty. Can we solve this by giving families up to $250 to $300 additional dollars per month, which were advance payments? This was money they were already eligible to be receiving back on their tax credits. And will this help people? And we really were able to show that the expanded child tax credit works. And so if we can, there's legislation that will be reintroduced shortly by a number of folks on the Hill that's going to bring back a permanent, or that if passed would bring back a permanent child tax credit. And I think not only is it we've proven that this works, it also opens the door for other opportunities for us to innovate and develop policies through the tax code that could change the circumstance for, like, the financial security of all families, but particularly Black and Brown families.
You know, I'm curious, from my experience, this is cyclical. This happened under the current administration. And even though it's been proven to be a success, you know, I mean, the numbers are incredible for just happening in 2021, you know, the number and the percentages of people who are children who were lifted out of poverty. So it's proven to be a success, but it hasn't squashed that rhetoric around giving people money doesn't help. We shouldn't give people handouts, right? You hear that in certain political factions, of course. I guess the question is, how do you do something more permanent? How do you go further, given the fact that it is cyclical? You get one party gets into power, they'll try to undo all of this work that's happened. You know, what kind of legislation, what kind of policy can we put forward that actually does make it permanent?
What's critical about the legislation that's being talked about now for the permanent expanded child tax credit is that it is, one, it is permanent. The challenge with the previous expanded child tax credit passing through the American Rescue Plan was that it was an emergency response program, which really meant that it was time-bound. It was connected to an emergency crisis in the pandemic, and the funds the federal government were able to get out under that crisis reached a new high because there was this thought, okay, we're record highs, unemployment, or all of the challenge that we saw with the economy, particularly in 2020 with under like peak pandemic crisis, the government response was seen as critical. It was much like we see in response to wartime or other emergency crises, we have to get dollars out, and it was time bound. I think what's critical for new conversations, and as I said, the legislation that will be reintroduced is permanent, but really thinking about poverty as its own crisis. It is longstanding, it is ongoing and persistent. And if we don't do something about it, not only is it going to continue, it's going to get worse, and it's going to get worse for Black and Brown families. And so we have to change the mentality in the conversations we have with policymakers, in the way that we're developing policy, that these are not one-time or time-bound crises. These are ongoing. And to respond to the like cyclical nature that you're asking about, I mean, I think a part of that is really, and I'm being hopeful here, this is not necessarily what I think is happening with the federal government right now, but really changing the way that we think of as what our government is meant to do for people. We have this longstanding idea that we can move through cycles of prosperity and then austerity. And really, that actually can exacerbate the crisis. It's great that we were able to cut poverty, but it's actually even harsher that more children fell into poverty after 2021 into 2022 because we took something away. And that's actually really dangerous. It's great that we have proven policies now through the child tax credit around what we can do, but it's really dangerous for us to go through these cycles. And so us figuring out how do we really convince, and the challenge now, and we saw with the debt ceiling crisis, is really there is a strong move toward austerity amongst both political parties. We're really seeing people say we have to cut back what government spending looks like. The deficit is a problem. And those are honestly, they're ways for us to reward corporations and wealthy people over families, to continually benefit a system that works to ensure people remain in poverty because poverty benefits the wealthy. And without breaking those cycles, we're really not going to be able to make any true long-lasting moves on poverty for kids or other folks.
Yeah, speaking of the debt ceiling and, you know, partisanship in these conversations, it's interesting that these conversations are happening at a time when, you know, one side is talking about the need to protect children from things like books, you know, they're banning books, or to, you know, protect kids for, you know, playing on sports teams with other trans kids, when we can't even commit to lifting children out of poverty. And that's just more of a statement than a question. I just think that there's an irony there and a hypocrisy, frankly.
It is really frustrating. And I have there, my staff and other colleagues and folks that know me well have heard me say this many times. It is really disheartening and frustrating to work in a policy space where exactly that, like I'm supposed to go and convince people to care about kids in poverty. Like from my perspective, it should be a basis of our society that we're keeping kids out of poverty. We're leaving behind a better society, a better world for the next generation. These were fundamentals. These are and should be fundamentals of who we are as a society versus the like fear mongering that comes with transphobia, book banning, like all of these things that are getting so much more attention. I mean, there are days where I'm like reading the news and it's like I'm hearing more about book banning or critical race theory, that which is used as a absolute fear mongering tactic, than the fact that 3.7 million children fell back into poverty as soon as the child tax credit expired in December of 2021. That's really disheartening.
It really is. I mean, you know, how can you say in the same breath, you know, we really love children, yet we don't care if they have food security, right? But I digress. I know that Prosperity Now does a lot of work around baby bonds, and I don't know what role that plays into helping lower the child poverty rates. You know, what's a baby bond? How do they help? What are they? Tell me all about baby bonds.
Yeah, absolutely. Baby bonds are a government investment that would provide a significant nest egg to start off adulthood and help close the racial wealth gap. The idea really is that upon birth, based on your income levels, your family's income levels, the government is setting aside a small amount of money that over the 18 years in which kids grow up, it is invested and turned into a significant amount of money to be put toward wealth building opportunities. And so those wealth building opportunities are defined as post-secondary education, home ownership, starting a small business. In some places and some states where we've seen baby bonds legislation come up, conversations around retirement savings have also been added to those uses. But the idea really is this is money set aside to specifically help respond to wealth building and a wealth divide and a racialized wealth divide in this country. And so it's challenging to respond to the question about child poverty because it's such a long-term investment. The idea for a baby bond is not that families have access to this money immediately. It's meant to be to kick off adulthood to ensure that kids that are born into families without wealth are able to better position themselves in comparison to kids that are born into massive amounts of wealth. And so it is certainly not a silver bullet policy. We look at baby bonds as one solution amongst an ecosystem of solutions that are responsive to poverty and the wealth gap, and really recognizing that we also have to respond to families and kids' immediate needs. So things like the child tax credit, cash assistance, public benefits, perhaps a guaranteed income, those are responding to the immediate needs of a family, whereas a baby bond is a longer-term investment meant to help to build and grow wealth. And there's a lot of, while baby bonds is a fairly new concept and very new in terms of implementation, Connecticut was the first state to pass baby bonds and was appropriated actually just this past month. Washington, D.C. has also passed a baby bond and has their funding appropriated. So we'll start to see the implementation aspects. But we do have research from economists that have been able to project if a baby bond study, a national baby bond study or program, excuse me, had been implemented in the 1990s, benefiting kids that are now 18 to 25 by 2015, the wealth gap of right now, the wealth gap of white households is 15.9 times the wealth of Black households. If we had implemented that national program in the 1990s, it would only be 1.4 times that of Black households. So we're really able to see a stark narrowing of the racial wealth gap through these types of investments.
That's a huge difference. That's a huge difference. You know, I'm curious. So how does that work practically? So you're a child born today or at some time where there's baby bond policy in place in your state or nationally, and your household, your parents, your family, they're under the poverty level. Their income is below the poverty level. And when you reach 18, when that child becomes 18, what actually happens in their lives versus being born without a baby bond policy?
So the idea is that at the federal level, the U.S. Treasury is investing a chunk of money upon birth and then over time adding yearly payments based on a family's income. So the lowest income families get the most money from the government added to this account. And over time, that gets invested and accrues into a significant chunk of money. So for the national program, we're looking at about $45,000 to $46,000 by age 18. And the idea is that at age 18, those kids now have access to this $45,000 to $46,000 amount of money that they are then able to invest in post-secondary education, a down payment on a home, things like that. And so the idea, recognizing especially, you know, we also have to complement this with lowering the cost of college and fixing our student loan crisis, and recognizing that $45,000 is a nice chunk of money, but in many places that is not even significant enough for down payment on a home. So, but the idea being they now have access to this money, and $45,000 toward college is a significant change particularly for the lowest income families. And so where wealthy families who are predominantly white have access to their intergenerational wealth and longstanding opportunities that ensure that they're able to go to college and able to eventually buy a home and all of those things, this is meant to level that playing field a bit. And so the young adults would be able to acquire this money from the U.S. Treasury at the state level. The state treasurers are running this. They disclose how they're putting use or how they're going to be using the funds, because it has to go specifically toward wealth building opportunities. And then they get access to this money and hopefully put it toward college and are able to, or home ownership or a small business, and really set them up for better success than they're currently being set up now.
I'm just thinking about this in the context of myself. If I had had $45,000 or access to $45,000 when I went to college, my life would look so much different, right? Especially my younger life.
Absolutely. Same.
If you think about it in the context of graduate, just working in college, right? Having to have work study jobs and study, perhaps you could do better in school if you don't have to work so much to, you know, because you've got this money set aside. You can focus more on your studies, wouldn't have such a large student loan balance, you know, which impacts your credit score. All of these things can reverberate to a young person's future.
Especially if we're looking at this in context, like you're saying, with the student loan crisis, with the quality and the experience in college. I mean, we have a tremendous number of conversations around retention rates for students, particularly students of color in college. A massive amount of that comes from economic instability, the requirement for people to be working to help provide for their families, all of these things that burdens that could be removed if there is that nest egg, if you have something to fall back on. If there's a chunk of money that you know that you're able to fall back on, it's going to change the way that we can approach. I think of myself, like going into school, having that burden lifted a little bit, that's a huge change. The other thing is that we're able to really set families up. There's a lot of research that shows that like families and kids that have access to savings accounts, like child savings accounts, 529 accounts, just other financial services, not only are they more likely to save, they're incentivized to save. And there's a lot of research that really shows that in the long run, you're just better positioned in your financial systems in terms of access to credit, access to lending services. And I certainly don't think baby bonds is the only solution that's going to be able to mitigate discrimination and racism in the banking system. But there are opportunities to be able to change access and services for the long term, for the whole like lifespan of these young adults. It's not just upon birth or at 18, but it really can change the trajectories that we see for young people.
It really can. I know that there has been a lot of legislative support for this. I know that Cory Booker, Senator Cory Booker, is really into baby bonds. Is that true?
Yeah. So Senator Booker, I mean, I know this came up significantly when he was running for president, but Senator Booker is the lead sponsor for the legislation that was reintroduced in February called the American Opportunity Accounts Act. U.S. Representative Ayanna Pressley is the House sponsor. We are actually, Prosperity Now will be doing an event with both of them on Tuesday, June 13th, to learn more and talk more about baby bonds, which is very exciting. But we've been working quite closely with Senator Booker's office on this legislation. When it was developed back originally, first introduced in 2017, and then, like I said, reintroduced back in February. And he's been a strong supporter of this legislation. We're also seeing a tremendous amount of momentum at the state level, recognizing that the federal program is not only is it the North Star in the sense that to have equitable outcomes and to ensure that all kids across the country would have access to this, especially knowing that there are going to be conservative states where this will just never happen, but also recognizing that the federal government has the money that it would really take to be able to truly invest in a significant way for kids. But we're excited to see this momentum because it's pushing, one, we're able to start implementing programs. As I said, Connecticut and Washington, D.C. have already passed this legislation and appropriated funding for these programs. We're going to start seeing the first rounds of kids getting their kids being born, getting accounts set up for them. We've seen legislation in Washington, Nevada, New York, New Jersey, California. And that momentum is exciting to see that states are interested in this, that there are particularly state treasurers and legislators that are interested in finding solutions for closing the racial wealth gap, solutions like baby bonds, but it's also going to push the federal government. I think at a certain point when states are outdoing the federal government, maybe then it'll be more of a viability for us to be able to pass a national program.
Yeah, I actually remember Cory Booker talking about this on the campaign trail, and he just had a huge smile on his face. And it was just really fun to watch Cory Booker say baby bonds while smiling over and over again.
I do wish, a part of me wishes that we had a little bit of a different name, because I know it can get confusing with like an actual bond. But it's exciting to see his excitement and the momentum around it.
Well, if you say baby, it gets people's attention.
Exactly. So. Nobody can get mad about babies.
Exactly. Exactly. But there's another area that I know the Prosperity Now has been working on that will be hugely helpful in terms of shrinking the wealth gap, the racial wealth gap. And that is the IRS tax code. And I know you've been working, or you've done a lot of work around, you know, hoping to improve that so that it's more equitable. Can you tell me more about that?
We work on the tax code on a number of fronts. We've already kind of talked a little bit about the tax credit side and getting money out the door to families that need it, not just through the child tax credit, but the earned income tax credit and other opportunities that we can make sure that families, particularly the lowest income families, have access to the money and resources they need. But on the flip side of that, we're really working to design a more equitable tax code by recognizing that, first of all, right now, we have a very inequitable one. We reward wealthy individuals and corporations by not only having what I think are very low tax rates for them, but also by not enforcing the actual legal tax rates that they're currently required to be paying. And so with last year's legislation, the Inflation Reduction Act, we were able to advocate for $80 billion in funding for the IRS to be able to really enforce a more equitable, recognizing that to audit wealthy individuals and corporations is wildly expensive. And so if the IRS doesn't have the resources to actually enforce their tax code, and it's so expensive to audit these folks, they're not going to actually be able to do it. They're going to continue to audit low-income families, and particularly Black families. Black earned income tax credit eligible families are the most likely to be audited. And if we don't do something to be able to provide the IRS with the enforcement funding they need to be able to actually go after wealthy corporations and individuals, we're not going to be able to fix this problem. And really recognizing that not only is it just a matter of getting funding to the IRS, it's also working to ensure that the legislation, tax cuts, we're going to have a new round of tax negotiations happening with the Trump tax cuts coming to an end or expiring here soon, and really ensuring that the only way for us to be able to fund and have the government investment and revenue that we need to be able to provide families with the investments they need is through the tax code. We need to get wealthy corporations and individuals paying their fair share. And it really is their fair share. This idea that, like, I think there's some myths and narratives that get used and played out that, like, well, wealthy people and corporations are already paying billions of dollars in taxes. Well, when billions of dollars is a drop in the bucket for you, then it needs to be billions more. And it is very inequitable right now. And there's a massive pushback against this. And I don't mean to get too political, but when one side is really being paid and fundraised by the folks that get the tax loopholes, then it's just going to continue to drive this inequity.
Precisely. And maybe it is political. I mean, you can't help but get political. And you just read my mind there. I was thinking that it's a really hard problem to solve when people who have enough money to donate to policymakers who can craft policy and legislation in their favor in relation to the IRS, that's a really hard problem to solve, because the families, the poorer families who are being audited more often, can't afford to buy, and you don't want anyone buying a politician, but the money circulating in a way that it favors people, that it helps them become wealthier. So, I mean, how do you even solve a problem like that?
I mean, I think the start was what we saw last year with actually reasonably funding the IRS, recognizing that we have an antiquated infrastructure. I mean, we're talking about technology and systems that are so dated. So that's kind of a very first start. It's also a job creation opportunity. There needs to be more people working for the IRS that are taking calls, that are helping drive services to be able to get to folks. Funding for programs like VITA, which is the Volunteer Income Tax Assistance Program, which we advocate strongly for, to be able to ensure that partners and community centers and folks all across the country have access to tax services, free tax services and tax preparation. So those are the starts of how we solve this, by really getting and making sure that the IRS has what it needs to be able to enforce the code itself. Then there's the changes to the tax code that we desperately need to be able to really ensure that corporations and wealthy individuals are paying their fair share. And it's important, and I want to acknowledge that President Biden has named that as a priority. It came out in his State of the Union. It's come up quite a bit. And so we know that this is a priority for this president, but we're not seeing the critical pushback that we need against those that are opposing this. And this came up quite a bit in the debt ceiling conversation. This is absolutely going to come up when we're negotiating tax cuts and a new tax deal. The massive amount of momentum that needs to happen on the tax code is super critical. And I think the biggest challenge is that taxes and tax policy and the tax code is not a sexy topic. This is not something. And honestly, had you talked to me even 5 years ago, had someone been like, oh, you're going to be this like big advocate on tax policy because tax policy really is about racial economic justice, I would have laughed in your face. Like, this is not something that tops most people's minds, even as a policy person, but let alone like random folks that are just living their lives and trying to do their daily jobs and all the things. So really making sure that this is known as a critical issue by getting the information out there, but through public awareness campaigns, outreach, digital advocacy, all of the tools in our toolbox to be able to spread this message, but really to recognize that the tax code has been co-opted and maintained as inequitable because it was not seen as a racial equity issue or an economic justice issue or a gender justice issue. And I think a lot of advocates in this ecosystem have been working really hard to change that narrative. This is about racial justice. This is about wealth inequality. And if we don't do something about it, we're going to continue to exacerbate it. And I do think we've seen momentum on that in the past several years. And the narrative around tax justice is shifting, which for me feels like momentum. And now we just need to get the decision makers to feel it.
No, you're right. I mean, there is a little bit of momentum. It's picking up. And I'm in the same boat as you. If you had asked me 5 years ago about taxes and how that equates to inequity and racial wealth inequity, I would have said, "Does it?" I mean, the assumption has always been that the wealthiest people were the ones who were audited by the IRS. And I don't know where that narrative came from, but I only recently learned that it's actually the poorest people, because it doesn't actually make sense to me, like that the wealthiest people who have all of these tax shelters and lots of money circulating around aren't the ones who are being audited the most. And so I've learned a lot about this in the past couple of years.
Yeah. And I mean, I think the fact that like books like The Whiteness of Wealth by Dorothy Brown and campaigns from folks like us at Prosperity Now, National Women's Law Center has a gender justice, like Tax the Patriarchy, a gender justice campaign. Like the fact that we are seeing this become more of a narrative amongst gender and racial justice folks, I think is really critical. And having Black and Brown people talking about this as an issue and really recognizing that we don't fix wealth inequality and a racialized economic system without the tax code. As unsexy as that might be, digging into a really wonky and overly complicated issues within tax policy, but we really have to, or else we're going to just maintain these inequities or worsen them.
Well, Alejandra, thank you so much for joining me. It's been a pleasure talking to you. I've learned so much today, and just thank you.
Yeah, I really appreciate it. I'm very excited to be here and to talk about issues that I'm really passionate about, and to hopefully help spread the message of creating a more just and equitable economy.